Yestok means Enkinek. Hello, everyone. My name is Christine, and I am the host here at the Hungarian Heritage Podcast, the show where we connect your modern life to your Hungarian heritage. We will build bridges between Hungarians who live in Hungary to those with Hungarian heritage who live in all other parts of the world, not to mention the bridges that we will build between the generations. This podcast is a place where everyone is welcome, where you don't even need to be Hungarian or speak Hungarian to join in on the fun. We will talk about all the things that we love about Hungary, the Hungarian people, and the Hungarian culture, as well as the cool things Hungarian people are doing around the world. We will discover new things, review things you may already know, and we will have a lot of fun along the way. So, if you're looking to make that first connection to your Hungarian heritage, or you're looking to dig a little deeper, then you're in the right place. Join me as we grow this community and continue to connect the circles of Hungarians around us. On this episode of the Hungarian Heritage Podcast, I will be speaking with Elizabeth Lukács Csesla, and she is the author of You Cannot Forbid the Flower, a novel about the Hungarian Revolution in 1956. What's unique about this novel is how Elizabeth was able to skillfully weave together stories, poems, and historical documents, along with the firsthand experiences her father shared with her about being a freedom fighter during this tumultuous and revolutionary time. As you will hear in this episode, Liz has placed her father in the novel as the main character who serves as the everyman, or every Hungarian man. Listen along as we discover and unpack the slices of our Hungarian heritage, the levels of loss we have all experienced, and maybe discovered some things we didn't realize about this time period and our own families. Please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Csesla, author of You Cannot Forbid the Flower, and she is here today to talk about her novel, which is a compilation of her connection to her Hungarian heritage, and she's included many things in this novel, which I'm going to let her tell us about, but I'd like to say that she's woven everything together so nicely with stories and personal stories, poems, and I'm going to let her tell you all about that. Welcome, Liz. Welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm excited for you to be here as well. So normally, as you know, when I record a podcast, we generally start out with, tell us a little bit about your Hungarian heritage. Mm-hmm. However, you know, we decided when we were talking about doing a podcast episode together that if you started out that way, you'd be giving away all of the secrets of what we're going to discuss about your novel. So we're going to kind of start in the middle of your Hungarian heritage a little bit. So we'll jump back and forth on your timeline. So tell us a little bit about your Hungarian heritage, but why don't you start when your parents met? Like, where were they born and how did they meet? Let's start mm-hmm. there.
Okay. So my father was born in 1927, and he was born in Giurgiu St. Miklos, which is now in Romania. Right? So it was in Sakeleni in Transylvania. And he was born there, and he and his one of 12 children and they all had to leave at the end of World War II, and they skipped to Hungary.
Okay.
It was then Hungary, because what was Hungary after the borders?
Right. Very complicated.
Yeah. And my mother was about 14 years younger. She was born in Pest. But she left. So my father, after they escaped, they were in sort of northern Hungary, and then he went to Budapest. But she was already gone because her family escaped right after the siege, or during the siege of Budapest.
Okay.
Yeah. So she was only three when she left. And had quite the journey.
Tell me where they ended up meeting.
Yeah.
Because it's not your typical story of how they got to the U.S. and how they met and then got to the U.S.
Right, right. So we'll go chronologically. So my mother left first, right, when she was younger. So after they escaped the siege, they went to several different countries. and then finally ended up settling in Venezuela, where there was actually a very large Hungarian community. So my grandmother was like a scout leader there. There was a big, you know, their schools and scouts and all of that. And then when she was a teenager, they moved to Illinois. And then she ended up in pharmacy school at Temple. So that's what brought her to Philadelphia. And then my father fought in the revolution and then escaped through the swamps to Austria, ended up coming to the U.S. Right before Christmas that year, 1956, landed in Camp Kilmer, or went to Camp Kilmer, and wasn't there for very long before he was sponsored because he has some valuable skills. So he was sponsored, went right into a job down in Delaware County, and they met at one of the Hungarian club events in the city. So then that was that.
Yeah, these are big journeys. Very big journeys. You know, I feel so lucky to live during the time period that we live. You know, we haven't here on U.S. soil experienced that type of turmoil in life. Hopefully we never will. But those are pretty big journeys. You know, when you look at people who are, you know, your parents, like your mom and your dad, or your grandparents, however, you know, whatever your connection to your Hungarian heritage may be, that's a big journey. Like you look at them as just like, you know, the people sitting across the table, right? At dinner time. And so that's a pretty big journey. So,
and the people who lost everything to get
gave it up in like in minutes. Sometimes it wasn't always like a planned escape. Sometimes it was, you know, within 24 hours. So even though people have very similar stories, everybody has a little bit different of a twist, you know, how people got here. And I feel like you can say that pretty much with many people that, you know, immigrate to the United States for reasons other than just wanting to come here, you know, for a job. Let's talk about how there's so many levels of loss when it comes to one's heritage. And like, I feel like that's a very important sentence. I feel like I'm in teacher mode now. Like for anybody that's listening, there's so many levels of loss when it comes to your heritage. So let's specifically discuss levels of loss for our generation. So we're kind of in the same generation. So when our parents assimilated here to the U.S. culture in the 1956 time period, you know, let's talk a little bit about that. Like what we lost things that many other people didn't. So tell us your thoughts on that.
So in my family, well, my father felt very strongly about having a Hungarian, you know, having a Hungarian family, raising us speaking Hungarian and with Hungarian traditions as much as possible. So I spoke Hungarian before I spoke English. You know, but going to school, I had to
learn
very quickly, of course.
Of course.
And we were here. So I learned both languages really simultaneously, but that was our language at home. And those were, you know, we're eating Hungarian food and as much as tradition, I think, as they could muster. But my parents divorced when I was pretty young. And so when they split, my mother, and I think that we talked about this, and I know a lot of people understand, she wanted, this was our new home, you know, their new home, our home, where I was born. So, and she didn't want us to have the same difficulties that she had tried to assimilate with an accent. And she had a very unique accent because she spoke Spanish, Hungarian, and English, you know, so for her, it was even a little bit more complicated. And really wanting to, and having moved around a lot, wanting to belong somewhere. And, you know, and then divorced us a lot of different things, and she was working a lot. And so we weren't able to cook the kinds of things and, you know, life moved on that in that direction. There was, for me, you know, a pretty big disconnect because after the divorce, we didn't see my father very much at all. He stayed local for a little while, but I think it was less than 2 years later he moved, and he moved far away. So that we would see him maybe for a week or two in the summer. And then there were some summers that we didn't even see him at all. So there was a lot of distance. From that, you know, and then we would go, and every time he would, you know, he would lament how much less we understood and how much less we could say, you know, back to him. But my grandparents, they spoke it, and they learned English. They were, you know, they obviously, you know, been here for a while too, and working and everything. And so they, they spoke English, but whenever we walked into their house, it was kind of like a time capsule, you know. Spoke English to us when they had to, but everything else was in Hungarian when they could. And my grandmother had this amazing Hungarian room. It was the smallest room in the house, but it was just the walls were covered with embroidery and plates and just artwork and books, lots of books. Everything was traditional art and
Yeah. Well, I guess that was her way of obviously like maintaining that connection to, you know, what she lost as well.
Right.
You know, if you think about it, you know, each person in your family, aside from like divorce, had different levels of loss, you know, especially because when you're older, were you the one who, you know, escaped or, immigrated, or were you the child of that? And I feel like being divorced, because my parents are divorced too, not that that, you know, has anything to do with it, but my mom was also not Hungarian. Not that that made a difference. I had so many friends where I grew up who were half Hungarian, just like myself. Mm-hmm. So, but that's like another level of disconnect from heritage, because of course you're going to celebrate all of your heritage, not just, you know, one side. So there is a lot to be said for the levels of loss for heritage. It's like an onion, you know, there's layers. It's, you know, who came here, you know, were both of your parents Hungarian? Did they stay married? All the different little layers on the onion affect how, I guess, Hungarian you stayed. Like, were you connected to a community, not connected to a community? So those things affect people. So, and those are important things to bring out, because as we lead up to discussing your novel, I don't want to spoil things. So these are important things to discuss. So whether people's parents were, you know, both Hungarian or not, definitely affects our connection to our heritage. It doesn't have to negate connection, but it does affect it, even if it's not in a negative way. It's just logically it affects it. Your Hungarian heritage, as you mentioned, it changed a little bit when your parents divorced, as many things change when people divorce. And, you know, you have like a new assimilation situation, as people do. And for you, that was a little bit of a loss of your connection. But you started to regain connection with your dad and your heritage. Tell us a little bit about that. Like, when did that change for you?
Yeah. So that changed for me when I was in college.
Okay.
And I was able to, you know, I could drive myself around and go visit, you know, I didn't depend on other people making visits happen. Right.
Sure.
So, and I think being, gaining that kind of independence that you get when you go away to school, you know, that just helped me really just realize how much I missed that connection, how much I miss my father, obviously, but like that, how much, I guess not to say obviously, I miss my father a lot.
You know, sure.
So let me clarify that. And I just felt like I didn't know him very much, which I didn't. And I really began to feel I needed to know who I was, and I was learning who I was, but I really needed to know who he was to paint the bigger picture, you know, like he was I'm a part of him. He's a part of me. And I felt this, that an emptiness there that I wanted to.
Yeah. We had a lot of empty pages because you were young when your parents divorced, and the situation that occurred afterward, you weren't able to fill in those pages.
Right.
Like you weren't old enough to ask some of the curious questions that you might've asked when you were 10 or 14. Mm-hmm. And now you have that opportunity. That's great. So you took it upon yourself to, you know, bridge that gap for yourself, which is great. And you also mentioned that you cared for him a little bit as he got older and he told you stories at that time. So tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, actually the story gathering started quite a bit before that.
Okay.
You know, I mention in the book, the Time Life magazine that came out right after the revolution and the photos in there. So my father did have that magazine, and it had such a profound impact on me, you know. So, and I was 12 or 13 or something around that age when I first saw it.
Okay.
But, and I knew that he had been in the revolution, but I really didn't know anything about it. But those Are you familiar with that magazine?
Yeah, I think you showed me pictures. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're hard to see, you know, and it left such a deep impact on me. And so over the years, I just, you know, these are questions that I had that kept bubbling up. So how did he fight? You know, what made him, he didn't have to,
right?
He didn't, he made a choice.
Yeah.
In the revolution. And then how did he get here from there? You know, and how did that impact him? And so as I got older, I became more and more curious and just more confident later, you know, when I was older to be able to ask him about it, because when I was younger, you know, I was a little afraid of him. And
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those were probably frightening questions to ask too, right, when you were 10, 11 or 12. And I feel like you hit a good point where you see these pictures, and now with the internet, like, you can see lots of pictures,
right,
and, you know, people do have accounts that, where they're showing those historical moments, and, you know, they are hard to see, thinking like, oh, wow, like I've been there, and like, wow, that's where they're marching, or that's where they're, you know, mm-hmm, things were not safe. And it is different. And not that this negates or changes anybody's experience who left, but when you have someone like yourself, like your dad, who fought, like, that changes the conversation a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because, and I'm not saying that people that didn't fight, that not thinking less of them, but I'm just saying when you have someone that actually, like, took up arms and fought those battles, that's a different question you're asking your dad, you know? Personally, yeah, like, I know my grandparents, my dad was 8, I guess, during that time period. My grandparents didn't, well, not that I know of. I don't know if my grandfather did. I don't know if he would have ever told us. But my grandmother was feeding, which I've said before in other episodes, but she wasn't physically, like, rebelling. She was rebelling by feeding people like your dad. And then they escaped within 24 hours. So, yeah, like, they were rebels too, but
right,
not to that level of the actual fighting. So those the questions I asked my grandmother and grandfather were definitely different than the questions you asked your dad.
But they were still risking their life.
Of course. I mean, yeah, people even that just left were risking mm-hmm their lives. So mm-hmm we don't want them to feel like they've done less. You know, people left because they had to or needed to, for whatever reason that they did. And, you know, obviously we support all those reasons, but I can imagine that the questions that you asked were frightening, because just looking at those pictures, you know, that's your dad. Yeah.
Well, and I just put this out there because if you read the book, you'll know.
Yeah.
You know, my father he was an alcoholic. He could be violent.
Okay.
You know, he never hurt me or right my brother or sister. But, you know, I had some pretty traumatic memories. So sure, visiting my dad was always a little bit, you know, there were a lot of emotions around that.
Sure. And you were cautious. You used emotional caution when you.
Thank you. That's a great way to put it. So I was cautious, and it took me getting older and, like, sure, I said, more confident to sort of build a relationship. And, you know, I wanted to know who he was and why he made some of the choices he made and sort of why he was who he was.
Right.
And, there aren't easy answers
no
to these kinds of questions, you know, mm-hmm, and people are complicated and, sure, and have a lot of things that, you know, kind of push them in one direction or the other. And so, yeah, I wanted to be able to paint a bigger picture of
right. And you continued to do that. You continued painting that picture for yourself,
yeah,
you know, even after you were married, like you continued yeah to care for your dad, and he continued to tell you more stories.
Yes. Getting stories out of him was challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but slowly over the years.
Yeah.
I got a few.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. It's good for you that you were able to paint your family picture for yourself. So then you yeah can, you know, share with your children too. So let's start creeping towards your book. Now, what, obviously, all of the stories your dad told you inspired you mm-hmm to write this, but tell us a little bit more, like, what was that final inspiration for you to say, hey, I've collected all these stories, let me turn this into a book? How'd that happen for you?
I can't say there was just one moment, you know.
Okay.
I think it's something I knew for a long time that I had to do.
Okay.
It was, but the circumstances aligned later, you know. Like I had been, like we said, writing down these stories for a while, and then sort of playing with ideas in my head about how to write it.
Okay.
But it wasn't, it was much later, you know, after he passed, that I was really starting to feel like I could tell the story.
Okay.
And part of that was just me gaining confidence as a writer. Okay. So that was honestly a big piece of it. But then I had a wonderful opportunity, you know, for me, thinking about how to tell the story, I knew that I would need to tell it in sort of flashes and fragments to reflect the way that I learned the story. You know, it was never, I didn't see this as being a sweeping historical novel, which it could be,
right?
Maybe down the road, other another project of that sort. But this was just sort of, you know, reflecting the way that I pieced together the story too.
Right. Because you received it in pieces.
Yes.
That's a great way to say it. So I feel like it's important that we now talk about the pieces of information that you received, because your book, You Cannot Forbid the Flower, is like an historical fiction book. So not everybody might know what that means. So tell us why you chose to write it in a historical fiction format.
So it could have been memoir, you know?
Right.
I think there are a lot of ways that I could have gone about this, but for me it was really important not just to tell my father's story, but to tell the story of the revolution. I think, you know, when people read the book and talk to me, I hear so often, I didn't know this. I didn't know, you know, but these are people who lived through the Cold War. You know, we were younger maybe, but,
sure.
You know, but I really wanted to share this part of history. It was such a pivotal event in the Cold War. And also, I just think it's the story of a people rising up against oppression and of a people, you know, fighting for their freedom. Unfortunately, we have to keep hearing that story. You know,
unfortunately we do. You're right.
Yeah. And just, I wanted to delve into some of the things, you know, that are universal, the dangers of nationalism, for example, and the impact of trauma on people who live through it and then on the families and the generations that come after. I mean, it doesn't just stop there. You escape and you bring it with you and it carries on.
Right. Exactly. So for those who maybe have forgotten, because you've been out of, you know, school for a long time. And I think it's also important to mention that we were both English teachers. So I'm trying not to get like too nerdy when I talk about like books. But historical fiction, it's where the history is essentially real. And then the characters, some of them could be real, but, you know, a lot of dialogue might be created for those characters. So in your book, your dad is essentially real. So it's like not a memoir, as you said, but you use your dad, even though he was there, as an historical character.
Right.
I found that such an interesting format, because like you said, you could have gone straight memoir. Like, this was my dad's story and leave it at that. But you chose to basically tell the story of the whole revolution and, like, right, you know, the Cold War scenario, and you infused your dad as the historical, even though he was real, the real character in all of the like the chapters, as the main character experiencing those experiences. When you read Liz's book, You Cannot Forbid the Flower, you're going to get so much information, as you just said, Liz, that you might not even know that you didn't know, because that's how I felt. How did you choose which stories to put in? Because I'm sure there were probably more. Yeah. And how did you choose which character to make your dad in like each one of like the chapters, essentially?
So that's a great question. So if this had been a memoir,
I
could only tell what my dad experienced. But even then, it would have been much, much smaller, because it would only be what I know or knew that my dad had experienced, right?
Correct,
so right. It would have been, this isn't a long book, but it would have been much shorter, right?
Right.
In terms of the revolution itself. Again, my knowledge of what he actually experienced is limited. And I wanted to tell a bigger story, but I wanted my readers to be invested in my father's story. and his experience, you know?
Right.
And so, I wasn't going to be a sweeping historical fiction novel with like this whole cast of characters and, you know, so to put him in all of these different places, I hope makes his, what happens to him in each of those places, the sacrifice in each of those scenarios more meaningful.
Right.
Rather than having a cast of characters that you don't know very much about.
Right.
It's him over and over.
Right. Yeah. So I have a very English teacher question that we came up with. And so essentially your dad is like the everyman or the every Hungarian man, and not to throw shade at women, but it's just an English term. You know, a female can be like the every person, the every person. So tell us how your dad was the every Hungarian man in the story, because he symbolized that as a character.
Right, right. And that's part of the reason that I didn't just do the revolution, but the build up to it, you know, including his experience at the end of World War II. But, you know, all the changes in Hungarian society and the government and, you know, how that led up to the revolution, you know, so that there was this picture of all of the different ways that people were impacted, hopefully, and the number of atrocities that were committed in just 12 days.
Yeah.
You know, and so the really so many sacrifices made by the people who were protesting in such a short period of time.
Yes. And there were just so many atrocities leading up to it. And I think that's what I also enjoyed when I read the book, was that I know certain things because this is what, you know, I was told, and you've added in statistics about, you know, how women were treated. There's statistics for that and other statistics that you included in poems. And I feel like that is really such a nice combination of what people experienced. Not that those were all good though, you know, but like you're giving slices of what life was like and the information behind it. Now, when we started this episode, we talked about your Hungarian heritage. So essentially, there are many parts in this book that do reflect your Hungarian heritage. And now your dad's experience is in this book, essentially, where even though he's the character, the historical character, in the chapters that he didn't actually happen to him. So if you read it for like the first time, or like, this is a book I have to go back and read, you know, multiple times, because it was such a compilation of information that like I was gobbling it up so fast. You know how like when you're really interested in something, so it's like to digest some of that information again, even though a lot of the information was hard to digest, you definitely have to like read it more than once. So you can really appreciate his history now. How did you connect that with all the stories that you learned from him? Like, did you have like insight now as to when you were younger, like what type of person he was through the experiences that he had? I feel like that was a very jumbled question, but
yeah,
sorry about that.
No, but I think that there's a question I get the same kind of question a lot, you know, like, you know, what I understood or thought about my father or my childhood change after writing this. And yeah, absolutely. But I think, you know, I was in search of understanding what happened, you know, and what happened, where he came from, where I came from. And I can't say I understand everything, you know, because again, there's still so many gaps, but I do understand a bigger picture. And I do understand, you know, we were talking earlier about our level of loss.
Yeah.
You know, and this, the depth of his loss, you know, and of my mother's loss and all the 56ers and other people who have had to leave and start over somewhere, you know, and I feel, obviously so grateful that to have the kind of stability that we have and not having to, and I imagine that sometimes, you know, what if tomorrow we had to just today, tonight,
exactly.
Yeah. I think certainly I have a deeper level of compassion.
Okay.
I think I always had some, you know, and I'm hopefully a lot, but I think even more, you know, definitely even more, curiosity too, you know, and I wanted to give my family, you know, something that I didn't have.
Okay.
Right. Yes. I had to create it. Right.
It's
a work of fiction.
Sure.
But
it's not really a complete, you know,
Right.
Work of fiction.
Right. It's rooted in all kinds of truths,
sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah. They're historical, factual truths and the emotional truths.
Sure. Because you did such a great job with connecting like the history and the timeline in the book, you know, what might be, you know, historical fiction for your family that might strike a chord with someone else's family and say, oh my God, that's what my dad went through or right. my grandfather went through. So we keep our heritage alive through connection and stories. And like when we spoke, we talked about how sometimes we only know a slice.
Yeah.
And you yeah. basically put all the slices together so that I might have recognized a few slices from mm-hmm. my family's experience. Same for yourself, same for everybody else. So tell us how these slices might be what people were looking for and how that might inspire them to make a connection with their own families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had asked earlier about or mentioned the different things that are included in there. There's bits of poetry, some of my own poetry, which is an interesting bit of story behind that, but also some folklore and some lullabies. And so, and specific mentions of Hungarian foods and things like that. Mm-hmm. For somebody with a Hungarian heritage, you know, that little spark of connection, I hope, was there in some of those ways.
Right.
Even if their parents or family didn't come over in 56 or experience a revolution, maybe they've been here for generations. But,
sure.
You know, still it's part of the heritage. Right.
Right.
So those bits are in there and things, other pieces that they might get, those slices are just the sort of maybe the conversations or the caretaking or mm-hmm. just the, you know, the relationships that we have with an aging parent, for example, or sure. a parent who's, you know, who we just don't know.
Yeah.
You're right. And just yeah. trying to get to know them. So I hope, you know, that again, that it encourages, you know, getting some of these slices and painting the pictures in this way inspires people to, you know, to maybe talk to their grandparents or like, I wish I can't go back in time.
But I know.
You know, if I could have visited my father more, gotten more stories, if I could have talked to my grandparents more, you know, luckily my mother's still here.
Right. And
we've got stories. I just think it's such a big piece of who we are. And
absolutely. And sometimes we've forgotten about slices. So
yeah.
I feel like the way your book is set up and how you really created your dad as the main character, the everyman, really helps connect slices for people. That's such a great thing because I feel like it's going to inspire people, hopefully inspire people to ask more questions. You know, mm-hmm. I feel like I love asking questions. I was always that kid, you know, I was always the kid that asked questions, but like, I didn't write a lot of the stories down, but you know, some of the things that you mentioned in the book, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that when a story. Mm-hmm. So it might be that you had the slice, but you forgot about the slice.
Right.
You know, or like, you right. know, a slice of the history and then some of the slices are new and hopefully, you know, people will really see that and see the value in asking their family more questions because it's really, you're providing the connection of your heritage to the next generation.
Right.
So it's such an inspiring book and knowing that it's like a hybrid, you know, historical fiction and that your dad, maybe one day you'll tell us which ones were your dad. Sorry. We must talk about the title. You cannot forbid the flower. So on the cover of the book, you know, there's the, you know, very traditional Hungarian embroidery. Mm-hmm. So the story, I mean, the title of your book is You Cannot Forbid the Flower. So tell us, how does that connect to this historical fiction novel that you wrote? What was your inspiration for the title? What's the meaning? What does it symbolize? Or is that something that people have to read the book to find out?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question. And,
okay.
you know, I think if you read the book, it will just be more clear. But
okay.
Because it is quoted in
yes.
in the book, yes.
Well, I didn't want to spill the beans. If beans were going to be spilled, I wanted you to be the spiller. So,
yes, yes. Well, these beans, we can spill these beans.
Okay.
Yeah. So it comes from a Sándor Petőfi poem. right? Okay. And I came across it initially, you know, he wrote the national song that inspired the 1848 revolution. And mm-hmm. then it was frequently used, of course, in the 1956 revolution.
Yeah.
And then as I started to delve into the research and into Hungarian literature, and I knew I wanted to include pieces, I do quote from the national song. When I just saw this poem, it just immediately I knew, because yes, it's a story of the revolution, right? Mm-hmm. But sure. it's also a love story. Yes. On several levels. And You Cannot Forbid the Flower is a beautiful love poem. And so, I mean, it's a love story, you know, my love for my father, his love for his country, his love for his family and for freedom, but also, you know, this sort of difficulty of loving after so much loss, right? So all these questions and issues around that. But I wanted a love poem to be the title, but also when you think of, you know, this, You Cannot Forbid the Flower is the first part, but the next part is to bloom, right? You cannot forbid right. the flower from blooming. And so for me, it represented really the revolution as a right. whole. You can't, like, when people are so oppressed,
right?
And the revolution has begun because it's just, you know, we're human beings who need our freedom and have right. the right to our freedoms. And so once that spark, it's like a flower that starts to bloom.
It's like nature finds a way.
Right.
No matter what, nature finds a way. So the revolution, I know it's a line from the poem, which I wasn't sure if you wanted to spill the beans on that, but so mm-hmm. it's a line from the poem, but also you can't stop a flower or a tree from blooming in the spring, even yeah. if bombs are going off, you know, mm-hmm. A few blocks down. And it reminds me of, like, when you see a picture of, like, a highway or concrete, or even if you're, you know, you're going for a walk and you see, like, a little, even if it's a dandelion, like, creeping through, like, the sidewalk crack. Like, nature finds a way for beauty. Even if you don't think a dandelion is beautiful, it is still nature. It is still something that found a way, and you can't forbid the flower from blooming. So, and mm-hmm. I feel like it does have a little bit of a, like, a somber, because, you know, we're talking about because of, like, a revolution, but there is beauty eventually, you know, there are flowers eventually. And sometimes it takes a while so that we can enjoy the flowers. That's a really great connection. And the cover of your book is beautiful as well. I like how you had black behind the matyo. It was very striking. What do your children think about this book?
Well, I actually had my son's help in making the book. He did the maps. He's a designer. Wow. He designs cars, but he's still able to do the map making for me, which was
a
wonderful bit of, like, having him be a part of it.
Yeah.
So they, I think, you know, so my youngest was actually born just a few weeks before my father died. So she never got to meet her, but remember, obviously. She doesn't have any memories to compare it to. So obviously we've talked about him. He has those stories, but this is just, like, really another level, you know, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, they're, you know, have the question that most people ask is what's real and what's fiction.
Right, sure.
So they're privileged to that information.
Of course.
And for me, I have purposely muddied the waters between that line of fact and fiction, because in the end, for the sake of the story, that's not
the... Right. The purpose of it is to share all of the slices of the history.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, I completely understand why you would have kept that private. But I feel like it's such a joy that your children are able to experience, you know, more of their Hungarian heritage through your work on this book, because, you know, it probably makes them pretty excited about at least that part of their heritage, and it makes it alive for them. And that's pretty fantastic.
I just want to jump back to your
last question. Sure.
Just because it's so exciting to me that I am starting to relearn the language. I tried, you know, when I was back in college, and there was just so much other things going on in my life.
Sure.
But now is a wonderful, perfect time for me to relearn. And so one of my daughters wants to learn it with me, which is just so. And so that's
That's exciting. Yeah. So like you're providing that like layer of the onion that she may or may not have had if you didn't find the inspiration to write this book. Like you've always collected the stories, but this is taking it to another level for yourself and for your kids. That's great. I know you've done some readings. Do you have any readings coming up? So tell us about that. And what did people ask you about? Like, what's a common question during a reading?
So yes, I have done several readings in the area and one Zoom reading. I think the questions are pretty common and they covered most of them, I think.
Okay.
I'm trying to think if there's anything that stands out as a different question that we haven't already talked about. There is one question that actually has come up a couple of times. You actually hinted at it earlier. There's so much history, right? And so even in, 200 pages, there's still a lot.
Yeah.
So a question that I've gotten is, how did I decide what to put in there? You know,
that's a great question.
Yeah. And I think that's actually where the heaviest editing was for me.
Okay.
Because I had a lot more in there. You know, I didn't want to lose people because there was, you know, without the context of the story, you know, but in some cases where I wanted the Treaty of Trianon, my father wasn't alive, but I needed that history.
Yeah.
To get the bigger picture of what was happening politically, geographically, all of that. So, so that was a real challenge for me,
you know,
to do historical fiction in a way that, well, I think that's a challenge for any historical fiction writer.
Sure.
How much history to include so much.
Because you want it to feel as accurate as possible. So I can imagine that was super difficult to cull, you know, that information and put it to the side, maybe next time,
but to also
make sure that the timeline that you're creating
in
your novel was pretty accurate and filled with enough details. The pieces were connecting. That kind of leads to my next question is, do you have plans for a follow-up to You Cannot Forbid the Flower? Because you've just told us that you have all these things that you didn't include. So anything we should be looking out for?
Gosh, well, you know, I did a lot of research. There's so many incredible stories of the revolution and the people who fought, who escaped, and before. And so I did mention my mother and escaping the siege of Budapest, which isn't that in itself is an incredible story. In the book, you'll meet Edith Bone. Mm-hmm. Who is one of my favorite, like she's a real person, but like my father, she's a character in the book. And, you know, she and my father never met, but in the book, of course, they're friends. So all that's imagined, but she was just such an incredible, remarkable person. I don't know what I'm going to write about her yet, but I know I need to.
Okay.
There are some other people. There was this Erica Selish was in the book. I had to cut her out. In the end, she was 15. Okay. You might recognize her. She's was on the cover of, I think, a Dutch magazine. It went, you know, as viral as things could go at that time. So she, photographer had captured her holding a rifle, 15 years old and ready to fight and die, you know?
Yeah. That's a heavy thing to digest.
Yeah.
A 15-year-old doing that. So,
So her story is incredible. I would like to do something to share her story. And there's more, you know.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, there will be a vampire story of some kind.
Ooh.
this is not a traditional novel. It's a hybrid. It's got all kinds of things in it. It's
I like that.
You know, I don't think I can write a straightforward kind of narrative.
Okay.
So it'll be all.
Well, that's your method. And that's how you're. I like that, a vampire story. So.
But not your traditional.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, you do have like a little bit of like Romanian connection there
absolutely.
As well.
Yeah.
So, Brom Castle, the whole. You know, I don't know if you've been there, but definitely worth a visit.
Not, but. But, you know, there's deeply cultural, metaphorical, fun thing to explore. So
I look forward to that. I enjoy those types of books as well. Wow. So lots of information in the book, but it's so connected. And I think that's what people are going to realize when they do read your book for the first time, the second time. There's a lot of connection that they can make, whether it's their personal history that they didn't know that their their parents or grandparents were also experiencing. If it didn't happen to them, it was still happening to them. They just didn't tell you that. So that's a pretty big deal. And it's a great novel. I really enjoyed it. And I think other people will too. Tell people where they can purchase your book.
Well, for people who are in the Philadelphia area, there are two stores that you could go in person and support local shops. Big Blue Marble in Mount Airy.
Okay.
Store where I actually did my first reading. A wonderful, wonderful place. And the Artist's Loft in Conshohocken also has my book and a bunch of other local authors.
Can they also purchase online somewhere?
Absolutely. So my publisher is Tolson Books. So Tolson Books.com. So it's you can order directly from them, support a small independent press, and of course on Amazon.
That's awesome. Well, obviously, I will leave all of that information in the show notes. So fantastic. Liz, thank you so much for being here today on the podcast. I know that you're an inspiration. You were an inspiration to me. And when I read the book, I was really impressed with all of your work. The research that goes into writing something like this is a lot. And I know that. And it's fantastic. And everyone should check out the publisher or check out Amazon, whichever one works best for you. And get your hands on a copy of You Cannot Forbid the Flower. You will not be disappointed. Thanks so much for being here today, Liz. And I look forward to more time with you, maybe as another episode coming up.
Thank you so much for letting me share this story with your listeners. I deeply appreciate this podcast and this opportunity.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. I really appreciate that. If they want to contact you directly, I didn't ask you that. Do you have an email that I can leave in the show notes for everyone if they'd like to contact you directly?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. I shall do that. Thanks again, Liz, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Liz.
Thanks for joining me today on this episode of the Hungarian Heritage Podcast. I hope that this conversation has sparked a desire for you to dig a little deeper into your own family history and maybe discover a slice or two of information that you didn't know about your Hungarian heritage. Don't forget to check the show notes for this episode to find out how you can connect with Elizabeth Lukács Csela and all of the ways you can purchase her book, You Cannot Forbid the Flower. If you have feedback or questions about today's episode, or you would like to connect with me at the podcast, you will also find my email, social media information, and podcast website in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode and you're interested in learning more about this Hungarian heritage community that we are building, please don't hesitate to reach out. I would love to hear from you. Our theme music is Hungarian Dance by Pony Music, used with special license from Envato Market. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcast so we can continue to connect our modern lives with our Hungarian heritage and grow this Hungarian heritage community. Until next time, goodbye, everyone. Sziasztok, mindenkinek.